from many other groups to spread the hegemony of Islamic law by violent means, and that that is the ultimate purpose behind the jihad violence that we see in the world today.
Okay, let's go back to the text. Can you give us a citation for why you say it's in the text?
Certainly. In the Quran, the Holy Book of Islam, you can see above all in chapter 9, verse 29, that Muslims are commanded to wage war against Jews and Christians, in particular, the people of the book, as they're called in the Quran, until they either submit to Islamic rule and pay the jizya, which is a special tax religion-based in the Islamic law, with willing submission and feel themselves subdued, the other choice being that they convert to Islam. Now, this is not just one isolated verse. There are many other verses in the Quran that enjoin Muslims to wage war against non-Muslims in order to do this, to offer non-Muslims the choice of conversion, subjugation as inferiors under Islamic law, or warfare. But this one is one of the most clear, one of the most obvious, and the one that's most pointed in terms of specifying the foe as Jews and Christians. In Islamic theology and Islamic history, this is underscored, this is emphasized by the many, many passages which have the Prophet Muhammad emphasizing that non-Muslims must be offered conversion, subjugation, or war. In the modern age, if we read the writings of Osama bin Laden and others, we find that that is exactly what they are doing and why they are pursuing warfare against the West now.
Is this a passage in the Quran that could be either an archaic passage or a passage that can be taken out of context? Just by contrast, a lot of anti-Semites will quote a passage from the Talmud as the basis of all Jewish deception in the world.
Sure.
But it's one of those obscure passages that only a scholar mm-hmm. would know. Could the same thing apply to this passage in the Quran?
Well, this is the key difference. This is the key difference that that really makes the entire distinction operative, and that is that in Jewish tradition, as you've pointed out, you're talking about obscure passages that most Jews don't even know exist, and virtually none are acting upon. Whereas in the Islamic tradition, these passages are well known, and not only are not obscure, but they are emphasized in traditional Islamic theology as being the Quran's last word on jihad, on relations with non-Muslims, how Muslims should relate to non-Muslims. And thus, being the Quran's last word on jihad, they're operative for all time. And this is what is taught by Islamic jihadists today.
Who exactly is teaching this?
Well, you find Osama bin Laden teaching it. You find many others teaching it as well. You find that in England, it's been taught by figures such as Omar Bakri and Abu Hamza, who will be familiar to people who have covered radical Islam in Britain. You will find that it's taught from Indonesia to Nigeria to Chechnya to Bosnia, really by all the groups that explained that what they are doing is a jihad. They teach that it is part of their responsibility to wage war against Jews and Christians and other non-Muslims. And this is a remarkable congruence, as a matter of fact, a remarkable convergence of ideology among vastly disparate groups. It's not just Al-Qaeda, but groups all around the world that teach the same thing.
To your knowledge, is it being taught in the United States?
Yes. We have seen mosques in the United States where the jihad ideology has been taught. One of the most notorious examples is Lackawanna, New York, where there was a Saudi Wahhabi recruiter. The Wahhabis are an especially virulent sect of Islam, although it's a complete misunderstanding to think that they originated the ideas of violence against unbelievers that are deeply rooted within Islam. There was, in any case, a Wahhabi recruiter from Saudi Arabia who came to Lackawanna in New York a couple of years ago, not long after 9/11, and he convinced, on the basis of the Quran and on the basis of Islamic teaching, six of the young Muslims there, who previously had been secular Muslims, who paid little or no attention to the teachings of Islam, that they were in risk of hell, and that the only way they could avoid hell was to take up this great good work, which was jihad, and wage war against the unbelievers. So he got six of them to go over to Afghanistan to try to join up with Al-Qaeda. Unfortunately, this is not an isolated incident. There have been other incidents where it has been clear that in mosques and Islamic centers in the United States, there has been the same kind of violence against unbelievers taught. And as a matter of fact, in 1999, 2 years before 9/11, Sheikh Mohammed Hisham Kabbani, a Sufi sheikh, a member of a relatively peaceful sect of Islam, testified before State Department Open Forum that 80% of American mosques were under control of extremists, and nothing has been done since then to investigate that. But it's a very serious charge and obviously has grave implications for the extent to which the jihad ideology is being preached in the United States.
Isn't it a First Amendment violation for the federal government to monitor what goes on in mosques?
I don't think it is. I think that our best analogy is the Communist Party, that in the Cold War, at the height of the Cold War in the 1950s, the Communist Party had an above-ground and an underground sector. The above-ground section of the Communist Party was completely legal, and it taught that one should work within the American governmental system to effect change. There was the candidate Gus Hall, who ran virtually in every election between the 50s, 60s, and 70s for president. And the idea was that they were going to try to achieve electoral victory and effect change thereby. At the same time, there was the underground Communist Party that, in contrast to the above-ground party, was not legal. The underground Communist Party that was preaching subversion by violent means or by deception of the United States, this party was not legal. And it would seem to me that the same kind of thing could be done today, that Muslims who renounce in effect and in action any attachment to Sharia, to Islamic law, and any intention of imposing Islamic law in the United States, that they would be completely free to practice their religion. But they're not free to preach or practice sedition against the United States, and that's where the distinction comes in, that any group that does allow the replacement of the American Constitution with an Islamic State to be preached, that is a group that that is something that we're not going to allow, because it's the same thing as the threat from the underground communists, that we're not going to allow the utter subversion of our way of life here.
Can you briefly contrast United States constitutional law with Sharia law?
Sure. Some of the primary differences, of course, is that Sharia is religiously based. There's no distinction between the secular and the sacred in Islam. The idea is that the Sharia is God's law, and it must be imposed because it is God's law. So that what we see in Sharia is a very draconian series of punishments, the amputation for theft, the stoning for adultery, the restrictions on freedom of conscience such that somebody who leaves Islam is subject to a death penalty, and so on. All these are elements of the Islamic law that jihad terrorists want to impose upon the rest of us.
Does that still happen in this day and age?
Yes, it does, as a matter of fact. Sharia is not fully enforced in any country today except Saudi Arabia and Iran. However, elements of it exist and persist as cultural hangovers, so to speak, throughout the Islamic world, such that you find in virtually every country in the world, in the Islamic world, that Christians do not enjoy full equality of rights. And even where they do have a general equality, they are forbidden to proselytize, while Muslims are not forbidden and are often encouraged by government authorities to proselytize. So that there's no place where Christians enjoy full equality of rights with Muslims in the world today, and there are various places where they suffer various levels of discrimination. In Pakistan, Christians are known colloquially as street sweepers because they are only able to take the most menial of jobs, because the discrimination to which they are subject forbids them, under classic Sharia provision, to hold authority over a Muslim. So they can only take the lowest levels of jobs in the society. And there was a notorious case in the 1990s in Kuwait of a Muslim who converted to Christianity, Robert Hussein, or Hussein Kambar Ali, and he was prosecuted under Kuwaiti law, even though Kuwaiti law superficially grants freedom of conscience. And he found that the prosecutor actually said that even though Kuwaiti law grants freedom of conscience, it must give way to Sharia, to Islamic law, which is a higher law, is greater than the law of Kuwait, and Kuwaiti law must be subject to it.
All right. On a related issue, your website, jihadwatch.org, has a sister site called DhimmiWatch.
Yes.
Can you explain what dhimmitude is?
Certainly. Dhimmitude is the status prescribed by Islamic law for non-Muslims. And so in Islamic law, as I explained before, non-Muslims do not enjoy full equality of rights with Muslims. They're subject to various humiliating regulations that ensure that they are second-class citizens. They are known as dhimmis, which means protected people or guilty people under Islamic law. And this means that because they're guilty, because they've rejected the Prophet and have rejected what Muslims consider to be the truth of Islam, they are protected because they are under the under the traditions of Islamic law. They're given they're given freedom from someone's here distracting me. They're given freedom from the from being killed. They're given protection for their lives. But it's a lot like mafia protection. It's in exchange for their accepting this second-class status, which mandates that they must not build new churches or rebuild old ones so that their communities are in a perpetual state of decline. And they must not, as I said before, in relation to Pakistan, hold authority over Muslims. And they have to wear distinctive dress so that Muslims do not make the mistake of greeting them with the traditional Islamic greeting, Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and various other regulations that have been enforced throughout history for non-Muslims, whereas there's never been a place or a time, and this must be emphasized, Dave, never been a place or a time where non-Muslims have enjoyed full equality of rights with Muslims in an Islamic society.
Do you think that there are that the United States is actually facing jihad from within? Do you think there are people who are out to overthrow the elected government of the United States and replace it?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, this is really a matter of public record. Ibrahim Hooper of the Council on American Islamic Relations, which is a group that's given a free pass by the mainstream media and to a great extent by the government as a neutral civil rights group, actually has said that he would like to see the United States become an Islamic state sometime in the future, which would mean the replacement of the Constitution with Sharia law. Hooper emphasizes that he wants to see that done by peaceful means, but really, as far as I'm concerned, it's the same effect, whether it's done peacefully or violently, because ultimately what he's asking for, what he's hoping for, is the institution of a system that denies full equality of rights to non-Muslims and to women.
All right. Do you personally dislike Muslims?
Of course not. This is not a matter of individual Muslims. This is not a matter of individuals at all. There are many Muslims who are wonderful people. Human nature is everywhere the same. And there are Muslims who do not pay attention to the teachings of Islam that I'm discussing today. And there are Muslims who have rejected them. And I say more power to them. I hope that there can be ultimately reform in Islam and large-scale rejection of these teachings. I hope that the jihad terrorists do not succeed in reasserting these teachings throughout the world. But the fact is that what we're talking about is the teaching of the Islamic religion. And that is separate from the adherence to it of any individual Muslim, and it doesn't change. The teachings of Islam may be incompatible and are incompatible with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and with universally accepted notions of human rights in the West, but that doesn't mean that every Muslim is evil or that every Muslim even believes that those ideas of universal human rights should be set aside.
Do you think that your websites, Jihad Watch and Dhimmi Watch, would lead to a backlash against Muslims in the United States?
No, I think that the American people are more sensible than that. I believe that the American people know that one of the cardinal principles on which the United States is founded is that you're innocent until proven guilty, and there is no indication whatsoever there's no indication whatsoever that the general any individual Muslim in the United States or elsewhere holds to the teachings that I'm discussing today. And so we cannot assume that that's so, and we cannot act against people who are innocent without any evidence. There's plenty of evidence that there are jihad terrorists acting in the United States, working in the United States, and we need to bring them to prosecution under American law. But one of the beauties of American law is that it does protect the innocent. And I am merely pointing out at my website and in my books that there are these elements of Islam that the jihad terrorists are using to further their goals and to recruit and motivate terrorists around the world. We need to be aware of this, but this doesn't mean that every Muslim is doing it.
Sorry, your most recent book is called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades. What's politically incorrect about it?
Well, it goes against the prevailing idea in the government and in the culture at large that Islam is a religion of peace. Islam is not a religion of peace. It's the only religion in the world that has a developed doctrine, theology, and legal system that mandates warfare against and subjugation of unbelievers. And so it's completely deceptive, and it deforms public policy in many important ways to affirm that Islam is a religion of peace. And that's one of the reasons why the book is politically incorrect, because I do not hesitate in the book and elsewhere to tell the truth about what Islam really teaches and to show that there are some elements that any Muslim of goodwill needs to reject in order to bring Islam and to bring the Islamic world into line with universally accepted notions of human rights today.
The President of the United States has said that essentially that Islam has been hijacked by radicals. Are you saying that in reality nothing has been hijacked, that what we're seeing is the real deal, the real Islam?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, Dave. I mean, Islam is not a monolith, and I certainly would never say that one thing is true Islam and another thing is not. And Muslims themselves don't tend to say it in general. There's no central authority within Islam, and most of the time, with some important exceptions, Muslims, they generally accept somebody else who affirms that there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet as a fellow Muslim. But the fact is that there's no doubt, looking at the Islamic texts and looking at Islamic tradition, that the Islamic terrorists are working from a broad tradition within Islam. And that's one of the reasons, that's something we simply have to face, because we're not going to be able to encourage genuine reform unless we acknowledge the problem that needs to be fixed. We can't fix a problem that we won't admit is broken. And so there's going to be no reform within Islam unless we acknowledge that there are these elements of Islam that do mandate violence.
We are speaking with Robert Spencer, the director of Jihad Watch, and you're listening to WPKN. And we'd like to open up the phone lines at this point. We have some time left. And if you'd like to ask Robert Spencer a question or join in the conversation, the number is area code 203-336-9756. Again, that's 203-336-9756 if you'd like to join us on the air. Is the website the main activity of Jihad Watch?
Yeah, it is at this point. Funding permitting, we would like to expand into quite a number of other areas, and we have a plan to do that, and now all we need is the funding.
Why do you have Jihad Watch and Dhimmi Watch split into what are basically connected but separate sites?
Yeah, separate but equal. We have that because the jihad is advancing by two primary means. One is violent and the other is peaceful. And to emphasize that there is a difference and that both are advancing every day, we decided to have two websites, two weblogs at Jihad Watch and at Dhimmi Watch that would show that they are indeed advancing the same cause and the same ideology, but by different means.
Okay, and we do have a phone call. WPKN, you're on the air.
Yes, my question is, we seem to be portraying the jihadists as guilty because the religion says that they have permission to be terrorists and warriors. But America has a strong history of terrorism also, but it's not against religions, it's against people of color. And so many Christians have used the excuse of the descendants of Ham to say these people at one time deserved to be hanged from trees, to be tortured, to be made out to be less than human. And so do we not as Christians use Scripture also to bring violence, not to other religions, but to people of color? That's my question.
Well, I would say sure. In history, you can find that, and there's no doubt that people of all religions have used their scriptures to justify violence. And certainly, I am not saying, and I don't think anybody else is saying, that jihadist Muslims have any monopoly on using their religion to justify violence. There's no perfect society. There's no perfect people, and everybody has sinned. Everybody has done things that they should apologize for. But today in the world, we do not have a worldwide global network of American Christian racists who are trying to justify racism and acts of violence on the basis of Christianity. But we do have a global network of Islamic jihadists who are justifying the violence that they commit on the basis of Islam. And so we have to pay attention to that and not allow ourselves to be diverted from the fact of that by some kind of moral equivalence arguments. The fact is that there is no religion, and Christianity never on any kind of official or large scale sanctioned racism. There were certainly Christian racists who justified their racism by scripture, but that was not the same kind of thing as having a consistent and unbroken tradition of racism justified by the Christian scripture. And we do have today a consistent and unbroken tradition of violence based on Islam and based on Islamic teaching. We have to acknowledge this forthrightly and take the steps to resist it and defend ourselves without apology and without being diverted because other people have done evil things too. There's no doubt that, as I said, no civilization is perfect, no civilization is without sin. But the society that the Islamic jihadists would like to replace our society with would be much worse for women, for non-Muslims, for homosexuals, for many other groups than the society that we have today. And in the name of universal human rights, we have to resist that.
All right, we are just about out of time here. I have to make way for the next programmer. So we've been speaking with Robert Spencer, who is the director of Jihad Watch. You want to give that website out again?
Sure, it's at jihadwatch.org, and every day we track the activities of the Global Jihad Network in the United States and around the world.
And thank you very much for joining us, Robert Spencer.
Thank you.
And you are tuned to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and WPKM at 88.7 in Montauk, New York. WPKN's open format allows for many individual views and opinions, and the views and opinions are those of the people expressing them. We encourage and welcome your response. You can write to us at WPKN 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, zip 06604. If you'd like to make an on-air response, you can call during business hours at 203-331-9756. My name is Dave. It's been my pleasure to have been here doing radio. And I'd like to make way for Janet, who will be on the air in just a few minutes for Morning Mommy Update. Keep it tuned. WPKN.org.